surely believed among us. We are living truly in very exciting times because there's hardly ever a day passes that we do not see something in the news that indicates to us that the plan and purpose of God is being worked out, and it is the time is drawing very short for a continued time or the continuation of the Gentile times in which we're now living. It has changed and accelerated greatly in the lifetime of most of us here. I have many times thought of an incident that happened in my life many years ago when I lived here as a youngster. And I was going to school down in Mayhill, a little village down the road here, most of you know about, I'm sure. And I heard a great deal. I grew up in a Christadelphian community here, of course, in this area. And I heard a great deal about the city of Jerusalem as I was growing up. And as you hear about it today in Sunday school classes and studies of prophecy, anything of this kind. But I didn't know there was any such city as Jerusalem. Really, I thought that was strictly a Bible term, and that would be the city that Christ would reign from when he comes back to the earth. But I didn't know there was any a city, an actual city of Jerusalem now. Never heard that at all. And one day when I was looking through my geography book down in school in Mayhill, I suddenly saw the name Jerusalem on there. And I was shocked. I couldn't imagine that there was actually a city today in the earth named Jerusalem. Imagine how that situation has changed in those years since then. Because there's almost every day you hear about the city of Jerusalem. Any of the youngsters today growing up, even they may not be interested in prophecy. They may not know anything about prophecy in the Bible, school children in general. But they know, I'm sure, that they know about the city of Jerusalem. And that's how the situation has changed so drastically from the time that I was in grammar school to the present time. So we can see the hand of God very actively participating in the affairs of individuals and nations in the world as the development of his plan and purpose requires. Now, last winter, Brother Blair and I had the privilege and pleasure of working together with the Orlando West Ecclesia in Florida for a weekend gathering and a Bible study. And the lessons that I have for this Bible school is just an expansion of the three lectures that I had there. They are now six instead of three. And I have broken them down into subjects, a different subject for each day, but it is all related to prophecy. Now I have those, do I have enough room to, yes. I have those. Now, this is not going to magnify as much as I had hoped it was, so those of you in the back aren't going to be able to read this, but I'll read them to you. But these are the subjects that we intend to discuss. The first one is, our day is like Noah's. Now, we recognize that Christ drew a definite comparison between that period of time immediately preceding the flood and the actual pouring out of God's judgment in the form of the flood to the time preceding his coming. There is a definite comparison drawn there. The second one is 2,520 years of fulfilled prophecy. Now, in doing this, we're going to be leading up to some of the other classes that we plan to discuss, but we believe this is a good thing for us to know also. But in the book of Daniel, when we consider the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and we consider the four beasts that Daniel saw in The image is in Daniel chapter 2, the beast in Daniel chapter 7. We recognize that that was a tremendous amount of prophecy that God revealed in this way. In fact, it has taken it some 2,520 years to unfold. So we feel we're going to be talking about the future, but we don't feel that it's that we can really have a firm grasp of the future and as it relates to prophecy unless we know something about the past and the prophecy that has already been fulfilled, plus the fact that this gives us a great deal of faith and confidence in the fulfillment of the plan and purpose of God if we look at his record to see how he's done in the past. He has said certain things would happen. Now we want to know, did they happen? Have these things occurred as he indicated they would? Because this is the way that people's credit is established in the business world today. If you apply for a loan to buy a home, for example, they want to know how you've performed. They want to know how you have paid your bills in the past. And if you have a good record, you won't have any trouble getting the loan. Well, this is somewhat, we're in that position to some extent in this case. We want to know what God has said he would do, and has he done it? The next one is, "Behold, I come as a thief." Now, that is taken from the 16th chapter of Revelation, I think most of you would recognize. It has to do, the whole chapter, 16th chapter of Revelation, has to do with the pouring out of the seven vials. And Christ spoke those particular words during or concerning the pouring out of the sixth vial. So that we recognize now that the coming of Christ will occur during the pouring out of the sixth vial. So we're going to be, the Lord willing, discussing all of the vials rather briefly up to the sixth one, and then with more time spent in discussing the sixth vial, because that is also where Christ revealed through the Apostle John on Patmos that the river Euphrates was dried up or would be dried up. So there are a number of things in that chapter that we're concerned about. Next, we have the week of creation. Now, we believe that the week of creation in the beginning was a type or a symbol, if you please, of the full and grand plan of 7,000 years that God will be developing his plan and purpose in the earth. He worked 6 days in the creation. He rested the seventh. We believe that that is a type of what we've seen going on for almost 6,000 years and what will be going on in the seventh 1,000-year period here upon the earth. The next one is the seven times of punishment. Now, this has to do with natural Israel. If we go back in time, as we will, and this is another reason we need to consider the 2,520 years of fulfilled prophecy, so that we recognize the place Israel has held in the development of the plan and purpose of God. And when we go back and consider them as a nation, we recognize that they were given the oracles of God in the form of the Mosaic Law. And that their prosperity in the land, the law did not in itself did not promise them eternal life, but it did promise them blessings in basket and store and long life in the land, prosperity in general, but contingent upon their obedience to God as revealed, as his will was revealed in that law. And he told them, if you aren't obedient, if you do not do what I tell you, I will punish you for it severely. And if you still do not do what I have commanded you, I will punish you seven times. And this is the thing that we're going to be discussing there. When it started, when we think it ended, and what was involved in this. And then finally, the sixth one is when the dispersion is ended. Now that is a quote from the 12th chapter of Daniel at the 7th verse, and it's taken out of the Septuagint version. That when we come to that point, I think you'll recognize why we're quoting from the Septuagint rather than the King James, because it does give us a better understanding, or does portray more clearly what we're trying to say when we come to that point in time. But those are the lessons. Each one is a separate subject, as you can tell from this, but they are related. Now to start with our first lesson, our day is like Noah's. Of course, we again call your attention to the fact that always when we gather at a Bible school, we are here or wherever the Bible school is being held, primarily for the purpose of studying the Bible, the Word of God. And we recognize that the Bible truly is the most unique book man has ever known. Now, primarily, this fact is due to the Bible being God's inspired word. He inspired the writers of the Bible through vision, through various ways, of what he was going to do and what his desires were. And they were commissioned, of course, to write it down so that it could be made known to us. So it is the inspired word of God. But there is another reason why it is truly unique. And that is due to the fact that in the pages of the Bible, and very often in the very same passages of the Bible, is to be found words of instruction and interest to the very young who turn to it for the very first time, as well as the more mature student who have been poring over its pages for many, many years. Now, this unusual phenomenon, if we might refer to it as such, is due in large part to the many types and shadows to be found in the Bible. Now, if you aren't familiar with the way in which we use the term type, maybe a brief explanation will suffice to acquaint you with what we're going to be saying relative to this. A type is something used, an incident that occurred, that was used to represent something else that's going to happen. And usually, if not always, the second occurrence is much more significant than the first one. So this isn't always an incident. It can be an individual. For example, David was a type of Christ. David was an individual who represented Christ. So there are many ways that this method of teaching can be used. And this is one of the oldest and most successful methods of teaching. Teaching by illustration. Now, this is very similar to the parables that used by Christ. Teaching by something that we see or know about, and using that as an example to teach about the more spiritual, the depths of the more spiritual subjects. Now, one of the examples that we might call to your attention has to do with David. And that was his battle with Goliath. Now, the very young who reads that for the first time, or maybe for a number of times, I think as youngsters, many of us can remember reading it very often, and we were always interested in it. It's a fascinating story about a young Hebrew shepherd boy who was able to successfully stand up against and, in fact, overcome a giant of a warrior, a seasoned warrior, and actually conquer and destroy this great warrior. So the young who read this course, seeing this, as we say, a very fascinating story of this young shepherd boy. But the more mature student sees in this a type. In fact, there are a number of types involved in the incident between David and Goliath. But we might briefly say that the more mature sees in this a type of Christ conquering and subduing Christendom at his coming, who is like the uncircumcised Philistine that was subdued and conquered by the young shepherd boy David at that time. So that's just one example of how we can use a type as it is portrayed to us in the Bible to represent something else. And it makes the thing represented more understandable to us once we see it. So we might say this helps us to better understand God's plan that is the genuine, and we see the genuine illustrated for us in the miniature. Now, last winter at the Orlando West gathering, there was a miniature ark on display, a replica of Noah's Ark that had been built by one of the Sunday school classes. And through that, we were able to look at this like a type and see and come to understand and appreciate much more fully what the real ark was probably like and the way it was designed to accommodate the various animals and people and food and all the things, excuse me, that were used. So that actually it did in fact help us to view the whole period surrounding Noah's Ark as a type of something else. And what is that? What else? What is it a type, or what was it a type of? We have already mentioned Christ made the very definite comparison between the days of Noah and the time surrounding his second coming. Let us look at Matthew, the 24th chapter, verses 36 through 39, and we'll see this emphasized very, very clearly. Christ speaking here, "But of that day and hour," that is, of his coming, he's speaking of his second coming, "but of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." So we begin to see how he's drawing a comparison here between the two periods. "Far as in the days that were before the flood, they were were eating and drinking and marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and knew not until the flood came and took them all away. So shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." So we can see then that actually the flood was a type. That period immediately preceding the flood was a type of the days immediately preceding the second coming of Christ. And we can also see in this that the pouring out of God's judgment in the flood because of the wickedness of the people of the earth at that time was also a type of the pouring out of God's judgment for the wickedness in the world at the second coming of Christ as well. Now, if there is a definite comparison between the times immediately preceding the flood and the times immediately preceding the second coming of Christ, then we are very interested in what the conditions in the world were during the time of Noah. Because from all the evidence that we have, we are today, brothers and sisters and friends, living in that very time immediately preceding the coming of Christ. So we need now to compare, to look at conditions as they were then, and see how they may compare with conditions as they are today. Let's look at the sixth chapter of Genesis, verses 5 through 9. Genesis chapter 6, 5 through 9. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man, whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and the beast and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Now, these are the generations of Noah. Now, we're not going to read that, but there's something in this verse very important to us. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generation, and Noah walked with God. We see from this that at that time, the wickedness of man was great in the earth. The imagination of his heart was only evil continually. Now, there's one other thing that we would like to call to your attention, and that is in the 11th verse of this sixth chapter. And the earth also was corrupt. The earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. Where have we heard that? So the real problem that brought about the flood, the destruction of mankind at the time of the flood, was wickedness, sin, corruption, violence. So this indicates to us that though God does not look upon sin in any form with any degree of toleration, there is a point beyond which God simply will not tolerate sin. And that point was reached in the days of Noah. The earth became so wicked, or mankind upon the earth became so wicked, that God would simply not tolerate it any longer. And his judgments were poured out in the form of the flood. And he had revealed to Noah in the 17th verse of this sixth chapter of Genesis, perhaps we don't need to read that, that he was going to bring such a flood upon the earth. But the important point is that, recalling now from verse 9 here, that Noah was a righteous man and that Noah walked with God, it was also revealed to Noah that God was going to provide a means of for escape from this terrible flood for Noah and his family because of this righteousness. Let's look at verse 14. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Room shalt thou make in the ark, and shall pitch it within and without with pitch. So there was going to be an ark of safety that Noah and his family were going to be able to get into and to be saved from this terrible catastrophe that was going to come upon the earth. And now again, that was provided because of righteousness. So we have two extremes. We have wickedness on one hand, we have righteousness on the other. And the wickedness was going to bring destruction upon the earth, and the righteousness of the few was going to save them from this destruction that was going to come. So then we should be able to, from finding or looking into the situation, the conditions as they existed just prior to the flood, we should know something about what we would expect to find in the world in which we now live if We truly are living in that period of time just preceding the second coming of Christ. Now, what are those conditions? Again, as to recap, the wickedness of man was great. The thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the earth was corrupt and filled with violence. We perhaps could not, if we tried, we could not write a more definitive description of the conditions of the world today that we live in than we find right here. We might write a description with more flair and more color than this, but when we boil it all down as to what it really means, there's no way we can describe it any more accurately than is described in the sixth chapter of Genesis, which took place, of course, almost 5,000 years ago. So these words are very relevant to the days in which we live. So we conclude from our understanding of this, the situation as it relates to the flood, our conclusion is that definitely this phase of our subject indicates to us that we are living in that period of time just preceding the second coming of Christ. But now, of course, we also know, now this is going a step beyond what our subject really calls for, but since we are using this to illustrate a point, we need to talk something about the authenticity of the flood. Because, you know, the critics have down through the ages have questioned the authenticity of the flood. They say that it is merely a fable or a part of Hebrew mythology, that it did not occur, that there was no such thing as a literal flood in the time of Noah, and there wasn't even any such man as Noah, most of them will say, that all of this is just something that's used like a parable. Or it is a myth, part of Hebrew mythology, and it might illustrate a point, but it didn't actually happen. Well, let's consider that a moment. First, let us say that the account of a gigantic and catastrophic flood is not limited to the Genesis or Hebrew account, not by any means. Now, many of you are probably familiar with the book, The Bible as History, written by Werner Keller. And in this, he deals with a lot of the significant finds of the geologist within the last 100 years or so, which have been dug up in the Middle East, and much of which concerns events described in the Bible. And in every situation, the Bible is vindicated in all of this. The indication is that from what they have found from those ruins, that the Bible account is true and authentic in every detail. Now, in this book, he discusses the fact that there were stories of a gigantic flood told and retold down through the generations in such widely separated areas as Greece, America, before the coming of the white man, by the way. The Indians had stories about a tremendous flood. Australia, India, Polynesia, Tibet, Kashmir, and Lithuania. And there is the account found on written in cuneiform, as the writings was done in the early by the early Assyrians, found on 12 tablets, which were written by an ancient Babylonian king named Gilgamesh, in which he recounts a story of a tremendous flood that happened. And now, very often these accounts that are told by people other than the Hebrew account bring in their pagan gods and involve their pagan religion with these things. But the fact that it's a, it is an account of a flood is the thing that is significant in our minds. And this Gilgamesh gave a lot of detail as to what had happened in this flood that he recounts. And I have seen those, even to the construction of a giant ship for people and animals to be in. And I have seen a comparison down. In fact, Werner Keller does this in his book, The Bible as History, to make a comparison of what Gilgamesh said about this giant boat that was constructed and the one that we find in Genesis. And they're not the same, but they're very similar in many respects. So now the critic would probably say, well, then what's on those tablets came from the Genesis account. That's how they were able to write a version of this, is because they knew about Moses' account in Genesis. Well, that might sound good, but there's something very wrong with that kind of a conclusion. And that is that those 12 clay tablets were much, much older than Moses' account in Genesis, so that they were written long before Moses wrote the account that we now have in Genesis. Well, now, of course, we come to the point now, we ask, how this could all be in such widely separated areas that the people could hand down stories from one to the other about such a gigantic flood. Well, we need to remember that after the flood, the world was populated by the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, so that the progenitors of all people saw the flood, they witnessed the flood, and it made such a lasting impression upon their minds, no doubt, that they would have repeated it to their children and their children's children and right on down the line. And so it became distorted as being associated with the various pagan gods and all this sort of thing in many cases. However, in the passing of time, one individual, Moses by name, in the line of Shem, was commissioned to write an account of the flood as it really occurred. And that is the account we have. Now, do all of these other stories of the flood, is that an ironclad proof that the flood occurred this way? And, of course, the answer is no. It's not an absolute proof that it is. However, it is. These stories are meaningful evidence that I don't think we can just shut our eyes to and pay no attention to them at all, because they are, as we say, meaningful evidence that such a flood occurred. Because many authorities, not necessarily Bible students, have concluded that all these stories of the flood concern the same catastrophic event that occurred. There's slightly different versions, as we've indicated, but the feeling is, on the part of many authorities who have looked into them and considered all the evidence, that they actually describe the same event. In fact, the critics question the authenticity of many things that are recorded in the Scripture that of a historical nature. In fact, over the years, they have questioned the authenticity of anything that was not recorded in secular history. If Herodotus or some other historian did not record a particular event, and the Bible does, they never took the Bible account. They took the other things, and its absence in other accounts, secular accounts, was evidence to them that it never happened. Now, another thing, in addition to the flood, was the city of Ur that Abraham came from, the original city, home of the patriarch Abraham. They said secular history doesn't mention any such city is this? Is the Ur of the Chaldees? Therefore, there was no such city as that. Well, that's interesting. They can't say it any longer because the proof of it has now been found by the archaeologist. Now, one of the interesting things about all of this is that these things were not dug up by Bible students. They were not evaluated by Bible students. They were dug up by archaeologists, by scientists. And these people evaluated what they dug up and said, here is what the situation was at any given period of time. And it is interesting that it falls right in line with the Bible account, what Bible students have known for hundreds of years. The archaeologists have confirmed, and these are facts now that are known. Of course, the expedition in which the ancient city of Ur was dug up is the one that was launched in 1923. It was a joint venture between the Americans and the British. And the man who was in charge of that expedition was a very experienced archaeologist, even at that period of time, by the name of Sir Charles Leonard Woolley. And after they were able to really unearth the ruins that proved to be the ancient city of Ur, a lot of things were found out about life there as it would have been in the days of Abraham, in all likelihood, and the many things that went on and the business that was carried on in that period of time. For example, it was a highly commercialized city. It seems strange that far back, but this is the evidence indicates this. They had a very efficient method of bookkeeping. And they knew advanced math. They were able to do both square and cube root. Now, I don't know whether kids in school today even learn square root and cube root, but the inhabitants of ancient Ur knew how to do it. And there were magnificent homes there, we're told, far surpassing the homes that have been found in the ruins of ancient Babylon. So, without a doubt, these things lend to the authenticity of the Scripture, all of these things. In fact, Sir Leonard Woolley even felt convinced that he had dug up evidence of the flood at the bottom of the tombs in the ancient city of Ur. Now, we won't talk a lot about that. Some other geologists disagree with him in his conclusions there. However, they were simply talking about whether that 10-foot layer of mud under those tombs was washed there by Noah's flood or whether it got there some other way. They were not in any way discussing whether or not there was a flood. It was whether or not that was evidence of it. So that doesn't, certainly the fact that everybody doesn't concur in that one thing in no way takes away from the authenticity of the flood. Now, the real proof, though, we feel that all of these things add to the evidence of the authenticity of the flood and all of the Bible account of things like the city of Ur and various other things. But the real proof is in the Bible itself. Now, Bible students don't need all of this other thing. It's nice to have these things. I'll have to say that I feel sure it adds to our faith and our confidence in the divine account in the Bible. But we don't have to have these things. The real proof is the fact that it is in the Bible itself. And in the Genesis account there, in the 6th and 7th chapter of Genesis, that's enough proof to us, but we have more proof than that in the Bible itself, because many New Testament figures also confirmed the Genesis account of the flood. Now, we've already referred to one of those, the words of Christ in Luke, when he said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. And he described there the situation as we find it in Genesis. He wasn't talking about some vague bit of mythology that was in somebody's imagination. He was talking about the things that literally happened there. And we go further. I think what I better do is give you these references and just with a brief statement about them, because we want some time between now and the lecture this morning, a little intermission so you can better take in the lecture. And we'll give you some other references. In the 11th chapter of Hebrews, the 7th verse, by faith Noah, this starts out, and the writer described how through faith, Noah built the ark. Literal, something he's talking about. And Peter, in 1 Peter 3, 20 and 21, where it says, God waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, wherein few, that is, eight souls, were saved by water. Now, this is important, the like figure whereunto baptism doth also now save us. So we see a further comparison of the events surrounding the time of Noah, that this ark of safety that Noah and his family had there in order for them to escape the judgments of God that were being poured out on the earth because of wickedness, that in itself was a type of Jesus Christ, who is our ark of safety that has been provided for us today, that we may escape the destruction that is going to come on the world because of wickedness in this day and time. But now, what would you thought about Noah if he had built that ark and there it sat and the clouds began to come up and God said, all right, it's time to get in the ark. And he said, well, I don't believe a will. I don't believe a will. Well, I won't tell you what you're probably thinking about him, but if that's what happened, well, it didn't. That didn't happen. He got in. But now, the comparison is here. There is an ark of safety for us. And are we going to see the storm clouds coming up over the Middle East today, and they're dark and threatening, and the lightning is flashing, and the thunder is rolling. And the ark is there. It's right there. Now, what about it? Are we going to sit idly by and say, well, there it is, but not get in it? Well, that would be about the same thing as if Noah had not gotten in the ark in his day and time. So I think if we have any of us today who have not gotten in that ark, ought to give it some thought. Because I don't think there's a lot of time left to think about it. Thank you.